Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You're listening to a Big Heads Media podcast.
Tonight is the beginning of season two, and we talk about two towns that are linked by the same ideology. Tonight, it's Steele, Illinois and Adelphi, Texas. All that and more on Small Town Secrets. Hello everyone, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 1 of Small Town Secrets. Season 2 is going to be pretty much like Season 1. I'm just going to throw in some new music here and there and a couple of other little things that will be upgrades to the show. Speaking of which, I have upgraded the studio just a little bit. Before, I was using my iPad to put notes on. I'm not a big fan of rustling paper on the mic, so I use an application called Agenda, which pretty much organizes and runs the entire show. It's got all the notes on it, it's got all the news stories on it, it's got all the listener stories on it, it's got all the future ideas on it. It's the backbone of this entire thing. And I used to use that on my iPad. My iPad was one screen, and my MacBook was second screen. But I have put an actual monitor in here, so that I can have a two-monitor, like, extended setup. Makes it better for research. It gives me a much better office space to work off of. And now I can use the big monitor for recording the show and editing the show and using my MacBook as essentially what the iPad was for then. One of the big reasons for it was, it's really stupid, but this is why. I got in a bad habit of not making sure the MacBook was charged, so I'd come down here to do the episode, and I'd flip over to the cover of the MacBook and be like, oh, it's dead. Now I got to plug it in and find a plug for it and find room for its cord and let it boot up. And after doing that about 3 to 4 times, it just got really annoying. So I was like, you know what? We have an old monitor in the back. Let's dig that out and see how it goes. I got that. I got the keyboard from an old Mac Mini that we don't use anymore. And a nice little hub to plug it all in. So now I'm only plugging in like one thing into my computer instead of like 4, 3. So it's working out pretty well. There's some adjustments to be made, but we'll see how it goes. The second thing is, and this is still very early in the planning stages, I am going to be working on Patreon. I'm not going to put any concrete date out yet onto when it's going to be ready and when it's going to be coming. I just don't know. I'm going to get it to where I want it to be, and then I will start dropping more information about it. But I kind of know, I mean, I know what I want in it. We're going to do some extra shows. We're going to make some music available. We're going to do some buttons. We're going to do some stickers, things like that. But when I get everything finalized, artwork and plans for it, I will bring out more information on that as we go along. But those are the two big notes for the beginning of season two. We did delay this episode by one night, but that's okay. This is an indie podcast. Sometimes it happens, but I do try to stick to a schedule, and I will try to stick to the schedule as hard as I can going into season two. We're going to get into something I wanted to talk about a long time ago. The thing is it's so weird because I plan out these episodes pretty early in advance. Like, I already have 8 of the 10 episodes for this season already planned out what I want to do. So after a while, you kind of forget which ones are coming up until you look at the app and go, oh, this is this episode. And then, you know, like, I'd probably planned to do this episode back in, I don't know, June or something like that. And now it is here. But we're going to talk about two little towns, very small towns. In fact, season two might be like showrunner for, let's see how small of a town we can get. Because these two are pretty small. I've got another episode coming up that also has a small town. And actually, I figure if I ever do an episode on ghost towns, those would probably win because their population would be, well, zero. But tonight we're going to talk about Stell, Illinois, and Adelphi, Texas. And these are two towns, tiny towns, that were started by the same man. You could call it a cult. I don't know if you want to go that far with it. You could call it just a group of people who believe in something, which I guess is a cult. But we're going to see how both of these places got started and how they're still around today and how their ideologies are very different from one another. Stell, Illinois and Adelphi, Texas are coming up. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the Dirty Knees Soap Company. I'm going to make, I think it's just a little promo for the next episode. It won't be too long, but it'll get the point across. I've been using this stuff since almost a year now. Since I think September or October of last year, I use the bar soap, I use the beard oil, and I use the hand lotion. And I do it all in the Minnesota Wood scent, and it's great stuff. If you get a chance, check them out. You can go to Dirty Knees Soap. You can go to their website, Dirty Knees Soap Company. Just Google it, or go to stscast.com. You can click on the support tab, and you can click through my site to get to theirs. And if you use the code STSCAST at checkout, I believe you get 10% off of your purchase, and then I will get credit for you doing a said purchase. So get on there, stop stinking, and help out the show all at the same time. The Dirty Knees Soap Company. Check them out, please. And we're also going to play a promo from another Big Heads Media podcast. This week is time sensitive, so let's give them a listen, give them some support, and we'll be back with Stell, Illinois and Adelphi, Texas.
You have to watch it. It's so good.
It was all right.
Your friends may have decent taste in movies, but their incoherent reviews are getting annoying.
I don't
know. I just didn't like it.
Looking for a new podcast?
Join Time Sensitive, where we break down the recent movies you've heard of but may have missed.
Spoilers included.
And we get it. You're busy and can't see everything, but are you really going to track it down a year later?
We take the time so you don't have to.
Find us on Twitter, at TSMoviePod, and find out what we're watching.
I'm Sam.
I'm Ian.
And I'm Kate, and we're three friends and armchair movie critics. Seriously, invite us into your living room.
Kate, stop.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
Time Sensitive, because you deserve better.
And we are back, or I am back. I don't know why I say we. I'm the only one here. Well, there's a cat, and I'm going to apologize. He's a little rambunctious tonight, but I think he's calmed down. But every once in a while, I might hear the pitter-patter of cat feet. He's a 7-pound cat that weighs 100 pounds, so he's not very graceful on his feet. But enough about the cat. We're going to talk about a couple of small towns, like we always do. We're going to start with Stell, Illinois, and I think we're going to start right this second. Located close to Chicago in Rogers Township, Illinois, is a small town known as Stell, S-T-E-L-L-E. The town's population is around 100 or so. Today, it's a very different type of place than you would normally see. The residents maintain their own telephone and internet services, and I'd actually be kind of curious to see just how good their internet service is. I bet it's actually fantastic. Like, I bet it's better than anything that we're getting. But they also have their own water treatment plant, their own solar power and wind power. Like, today, it's a tight-knit community focusing on sustainable living. However, that hasn't always been the community's purpose. Stell was founded in 1972 by the Stell Group. The organization was headed by Richard Kyinger. Richard Kyinger was a follower of the Lemurian philosophy. And in the 1950s, he belonged to the Lemurian Fellowship out in Ramon, California, until he was kicked out. Why? Because Kyinger started using his own ideas about Lemuria. Actually, I'm speculating a little bit. That's why I think he was actually kicked out. The official reason was for plagiarism. He claimed that he was in contact with the races of aliens, and I think also humans, like a mixture. In 1963, Kyinger wrote a book about his philosophies and experience called The Ultimate Frontier. He wrote this book under the pen name, I'm going to try to pronounce this pen name, but it is completely made of babble, I think, Ikal Kasuna, maybe. The book would go on to sell over 250,000 copies, attracting many to Kyinger's cause. Because of the success of the book, he was able to quickly found the Stell Group, and in 1973, he would purchase land in Ford County, Illinois, and construction began on Stell. I have the book. You can get the book. Actually, it's gone up. I think I bought it a while back. I got it for like $2 off Amazon. Like, an original copy, too. It's, you know, some book from the, you know, it's a book. It's a 1963 UFO contact ebook. So it's a little dense. It's a little dry. I didn't sit down and read it cover to cover. I did flip through. A lot of it is just about his experiences as a kid with this so-called brotherhood and how they, of course, had chosen him, you know, to be the purveyor of this information. But if you want a link, I have a link in the show notes. You can go to Amazon. You can get it, you know, $3, $4, if you're interested in checking it out. I think there's plenty of copies. You're going to be fine. As an interesting side note to these brotherhood beings, they did apparently fly around in dish-shaped craft. Both the kind of on-Earth and the off-Earth ones. These craft were really similar to the ones that George Adamski had photographed and talked about in the 1950s. It's interesting to know that because Kyinger apparently never had any contact with Adamski. And also a lot of the Brotherhood descriptions would match Adamski's descriptions of the beings. So it's kind of interesting, you know, the things that George Adamski saw back in the 50s, and if you're a UFO buff, you know about George Adamski. We might, depending on if I can nail it down, we might pick on that a little bit later in another episode. We might do him. But, or was Kyinger, I don't want to say stealing this idea, did he borrow these descriptions? Because as we will find out, maybe Kyinger wasn't as honest about things as he probably could have been or should have been. Richard would go on to claim that he would occasionally have run-ins from these Brotherhood members. And this is a quote from... I want to stop here and mention that a lot of this information comes from the UFO Archives blog by Honken Blomqvist, which is phenomenal. Once again, there will be a link to this blog post in the show notes, but check out everything. You'll find just so much interesting stuff to read and just so many rabbit holes to fall down. But anyway, here's a quote from Richard from the UFO Archives blog. "There hasn't been a large sampling of Brotherhoods I've run into. They don't tell me what they do for a living, and their work for the Brotherhoods may be quite separate from their everyday work to earn a living. The one brother with whom I've had most contact is John, who I met in Arizona. I've seen the car he drives, but he doesn't show me the license plates." Which, I don't get it. I don't know, maybe it's like a Men in Black car or something. I mean, that's what he's getting at, but it's a strange quote. But it gives you a little bit of an insight of to Richard Kellinger and how he thought and what he was talking about. But we need to stop and talk a little bit before we go on about Lemuria, if people don't know what Lemuria is. And Lemuria is the name for a supposed lost continent, much like Atlantis. This lost land is said to have been a land bridge linking Madagascar and India. In 1864, biographer Philip Schulter proposed a theory in a book titled The Mammals of Madagascar. He noticed that there were lemur fossils in Madagascar and in India, but nowhere else. This led him to assume that India and Madagascar were linked by a landmass. This landmass became known as Lemuria. And yes, Lemuria it's named after lemurs, Lemuria. But that's what that is, and it's a lot of people have, you know, glommed onto it with a lot of different ideas about the people that lived there and, you know, how it might have been this society that was way more advanced than anything we had at the time, and we lost it, and now we've been, you know, set back thousands of years, and who knows, maybe aliens started. There's a lot of good stuff, but not for this show. But that's what Lemuria is, and that's where he's kind of coming from this. The town started as an assortment of 25 homes, along with sewage, water treatment plant, roads, utilities, a school, and the Stell factory. All of this was owned and built by members of the town. The factory itself had four divisions. There was Stell Woodworking, Stell Construction, Stell Plastics, and the one that I find really interesting, the Stell Piano Shop. Kinder predicted that by the year 2000, 250,000 people would reside in Stell. But this never happened, mainly in part to its location. It was out kind of in the middle of nowhere. It wasn't close enough to any sort of place that had a good grip on jobs. And that, you know, they just didn't have the infrastructure to make it happen. And of course, you had to be a member of the Stell group. It was a closed community. You couldn't just move in there and start living. You had to be a member of the Stell group. And there were, from what I've read, there were pretty stringent membership applications to get in there. So that those two things really hindered the town's progress and its growth. The largest Stell would ever get would be 200 people. That was at its peak. And like I said, to this day, there's about 100-ish. That reside there. In 1975, Kellinger would again be ousted from another community. This one he helped create, and that is Stell. He was kicked out for the most of the same junk that these quote-unquote cult leaders always get kicked out for. You know, he kind of just lied about everything, and people, I think, saw through it pretty quick, especially the people in Stell. He took liberties with a lot of rules that he probably set up. He took liberties with many of the women in the community, if you know what I mean. And after only, what did I say, 72 he started this? So that's what, 3 years? That's 3 years, and they want him gone, they kick him out, and he leaves. But that wouldn't be the last the world would hear of Richard Kellinger, because he would go on to start another community. He would try it again, and that would be down in Adelphi, Texas, And that's going to be part two of tonight's episode. So like I said, wouldn't be the last we heard of Richard Kellinger. After he was turned away from Stell, in the mid-70s, he ventured down south, just outside of Houston, Texas, where he set up another community based on the Lemurian Brotherhood teachings. This place would be dubbed Adelphi. As I stated earlier, Kellinger was kicked out for a myriad of reasons. Allegedly he abused power often, he had many inappropriate relationships with the young women in the community, and he pretty much lied about everything. One former resident of Stell, Walter Cox, had some things to say about Kellinger. And here's another quote. This is also from the Blomkvistvog, but I believe these are taken from the podcast series about residents in Stell. And I will link to that podcast series in the show notes. It's not really one that you can subscribe to via iTunes and stuff like that. Kind of have to go to the website and just stream it from there, but if you're interested in this topic and you really want to take a deep dive, then the Stell Experience podcast is the resource you really need to be looking into. But here's what Cox had to say about Kellinger. To sum it up, I would say that Richard Kellinger showed less respect for the truth than any person I'd ever met. He lied about everything, large and small. He lied when there was no reason to lie. He lied to avoid the natural repercussions of his actions. He lied to his wife, his many girlfriends, his daughter, and every friend he ever had. Does that mean that I think the philosophy in The Ultimate Frontier is false? No. I think the philosophy itself is sound, and I'm thankful Richard wrote the book. However, was Richard making it all up? Cox also had a very interesting story to relate. He tells the story of a friend named Victor, not his real name, it was an alias used by Cox, and this guy was also a resident of Stell. But we're going to talk about Victor for a little bit, just because it's a little bit of a sidetrack, but it really gives you insight onto what this was all about. Victor was a member of the Stell community for a long time. It would be in 1980, and at this time the community was still following the Brotherhood. Even though Kellinger was gone, it wouldn't be until like 1982 when they would put out a referendum and become just a homeowners association, and they would leave all of that frontier stuff, all that Brotherhood stuff, all that Lemurian stuff behind, and just become this community focused on being sustainable and being themselves. But back to Victor. Victor became disillusioned with Stell and what it stood for. One night, he would pray to both the Brotherhood and to God, asking them if it was all real, or if he and his family were wasting their time. Had he made the wrong choice? The next morning, he got a phone call. The voice on the other end had this to say. Hello, I'm calling in reference to your request for more information. I'm calling to answer your questions about Richard Kellinger and the validity of your presence in Stell. Perhaps we can arrange a meeting. Victor accepted, and the meeting was set up, and a few days later, a large Mercedes pulled up to his home. An elderly Asian man got out, followed by a young man who looked to be around 15 or so. It was actually the boy who did the talking. The old man just stayed in the car. He told Victor that this was his first assignment from the Brotherhood, and he had some important information to relay. The info Jim had for Victor concerned Kellinger. Victor was told that as a boy, Kellinger was indeed contacted by the Brotherhood, but later they realized that he would misuse the information given to him. Because of this, so-called keepers were assigned to Kellinger for a damage control, so he had referees out there from the Brotherhood trying to keep him in line as best they could. Doesn't look like they did like a tremendous job of it. Jim encouraged Victor to take on a more leadership role in Stell. Victor was assured that the Brotherhood had Stell's best interest in mind, and the community was on the correct path. Because of this, Victor decided to stay. And it doesn't really stop there. Years later, in the 90s, Victor was able to track Jim down via the internet. Victor had once again started to doubt Stell's purpose, and once again, Jim reassured him. Even though Jim was very taken aback, very surprised that Victor was able to find him. Later, Victor would try to contact Jim a second time. This time, however, he had no such luck. All the information he had for him was dead. The phone number, everything. He just disappeared after that, and he was never able to get a hold of him again. And that's the story of Victor. And make what you will of it, but it's intriguing, to say the least. And if it's true, then maybe there is something to what Kinder is doing. Maybe Kinder just wasn't the man for the job. Adelphi was established in 1976, and while it strived to be Kinder's second chance at his grand plan, it would never surpass the initial success of Stell. Even with the people that followed him from Stell to Adelphi, Adelphi would only be 100 members or so strong at its peak. Kinder would once again be kicked out of the community he started. In 1989, the Adelphi organization, which I'm assuming is the same as the Stell group, but just for Adelphi, sued Kinder and had him removed from the board. And I'm not sure why. They sued him. They brought him to court. There's a link in the show notes of the documents of the court proceedings. And I found one little bit of information about how he was involved with some sort of bank scheme, but I couldn't find any real information on this bank scheme. It had a name, and when I googled it, you just got banks in Houston or something. So I don't know if those two are connected. I feel like they are. I think it was a combination of this bank scheme that he was a part of and probably more of the same stuff that he was doing in Stell that got him once again kicked out of his own community. And he would die in 2002. Adelphi, like Stell, still carries on today. However, unlike Stell, which distances themselves from the Brotherhood teachings, Adelphi still holds strong to them. Today, Adelphi's population is 16, and that really is the thing. You have these two communities started by the same person. One community does everything they can really to distance themselves from their past. Even if you go and read their Wikipedia page, you can, like, they talk about it, they acknowledge it, but they really play it down. It was written very carefully, I think. So whomever is running that kind of Wikipedia page has to be from the community. Whereas Adelphi is still Lemurian Brotherhood, and you have to be a member, and da-da-da, da-da-da. It seems like a lot of people, which is also very cult-like, you see, a lot of them still believe in the message. They just don't believe in the person that gave them the message. And that's what we're seeing here, is that, and I mean, really, maybe that's good, because it could have ended up like a lot of other cults. But, you know, these people had the wherewithal. They still were, you know, he wasn't one of those leaders that just brainwashed everyone, apparently, and just took everything they had. I don't think he was really out to be a quote-unquote cult leader. He wasn't out to just take everybody's money and amass all this power. He wasn't trying to be a Jonestown. He wasn't trying to be an Om Shinrikyo. I think he really did have a message, and I think it just went to his head, because you see that the people, it doesn't take long that the people that he has gathered, they don't put up with his shit, quite frankly, and they turn on him and they take the power back. So both places are still around. Like I said, you want to get into Adelphi, you got to join. If you go there and you join and you're member number 17, drop me an email. Stell, like I said, it's just a homeowners association. I've linked to their website. I linked to both of their respective websites, and you can look at houses that they have for sale in Stell. Not terrible prices, to be honest, but keep in mind you're out in the middle of nowhere and you have to help raise barns, and they have their own internet, which could be amazing, could be terrible. I don't know. But those are the two. You know, check out the book. Really check out that podcast series. There's a myriad of things. Also, if you have a Plus membership to Mysterious Universe, they do an excellent Plus episode on this. It's a bit old. I think it's getting ready to go into the archives. It is episode 1915 of Plus. That's a great episode to check out on this topic as well. But I really wanted to get more into the towns and where they went. But that is our main meat for episode 1 of season 2. We're going to be back after the break with the local headlines, as we always do. So I'll see you. You'll hear me, actually, in a couple of seconds. I'm going to take a break, but you won't know, because it's a podcast that I treat like a radio show, even though it isn't. I'll be back. And we're back, and yes, I know that's not new music. I am working on a couple of new pieces for season 2. I don't really make a habit of trying to, like, oh, we gotta make music for the show. It's just when I get around to dabbling into it and go, oh, this is going somewhere, then I've got a new piece. I don't try to, like, adhere to that. It's just a fun thing to do. It's something to just grab the iPad and plug it in the Logic Pro and start hitting keys and messing with stuff and make a couple pieces of music for the show or whatever. But let's do some local headlines. The first one is from Coast to Coast, of course, written by Tim Banal. The headline reads, watch, and there's a YouTube video that you can watch when you go. I'll link to it in the show notes like I always do. Odd UFO cluster spotted in Texas. A driver in Texas was left scratching her head after spying a strange cluster of dark objects hovering in the sky. The weird sighting reportedly took place in the city of Odessa this past Tuesday, and the unnamed motorist was stopped at a red light. While waiting for the signal to change, she gazed up in the sky and noticed the puzzling aerial anomalies. The witness initially suspected that the oddities were simply balloons or birds, but she began to doubt that assessment when she noticed that one of the objects appeared to flash. Unfortunately, the light eventually turned green, and so the witness was forced to leave the scene. To her credit, she did try and turn her car around to see if she could spot the UFOs again. As for what the weird UFOs could have been, aside from the armada of alien craft cruising over Odessa, there are a handful of prosaic possibilities. that have been forwarded by viewers. On the fantastic end of the spectrum, some have postulated that perhaps the anomalies are clandestine government test craft. Meanwhile, more down-to-earth observers have argued that the UFOs are just paragliders. What's your theory for the source of the puzzling dark objects? Let us know on the Coast to Coast AM Facebook page. And Texas is not the only one having UFOs flying overhead. Actually, I think there was another sighting somewhere in the U.S., but it was quickly debunked as being something not UFO at all, so I didn't do it. But this one is coming from the good old mysteriousuniverse.org. Bizarre dancing fireball UFO filmed over in England for a second time. This is written by Sequoia Kennedy. How would you feel if you looked out your window and saw a giant ball of fire doing loops across the sky? That's got to be one of the most unnerving types of UFOs to see. An alien spaceship might be a little reality-shattering, but at least there would be a little bit of context. It's a real-world vehicle, but at least you know what vehicle. A big ball of fire, apocalyptically pirouetting over a small English town, though? That's just plain odd. The latest mysterious fireball was seen in the skies over Northampton, England. Luke Posse, 20, spoke to the Northampton Chronicle and Echo about the video of the bizarre event. Filmed by his friend, Lauren Tester, at her home. You can watch the video for yourself here, and there's a link to go check it out. The footage is short, only a few seconds long, but it shows a large flaming object doing loops in the sky. You can even see the smoke from the previous loops faintly to the right of the fireball, indicating that, in fact, it's a literal great ball of fire. Luke Halsey says he doesn't believe that the fireball was man-made, or a weird type of lightning. He believes that it in some way was alien. Halsey says, I think it's an unidentified flying object. But when people imagine that they think of a spaceship, which I don't think it was, but how do we know what's out there? Especially if it doesn't exist to us. It could be aliens, but I don't want to say for certain, as I don't know. Strangely, it seems that Palsy and Tester are the only witnesses to the bizarre event. Palsy says it's hard to believe that no one else saw the dancing fireball in the sky. It's baffling, and it really is a mystery. That's why I'm so interested in it. No one knows what it is, and by the time you get someone to look at it, it's gone. Yet this isn't the first time a big, ridiculous, and unexplained fireball has appeared. It's not even the first time it's happened in Northampton. In 2014, a video was posted online of what can only be described as probably the same thing. 11-year-old Katie Reel filmed a looping fireball UFO over Northampton as her parents watched. Fiona Fearon, Katie's mom, said in 2014, initially we thought it could be a plane on fire, but it appeared to be dancing across the sky. It was an amazing sight. It's very weird. Our children were very excited by it. It looked like a ball of fire moving around the sky. Often mysterious fireballs and dancing lights are explained away with two words, ball lightning. The problem with that is, although it's a term composed of two words, we know ball and lightning. Science still considers ball lightning to be an unexplained phenomenon. It's called a type of lightning because it's associated with thunderstorms, sometimes, and because it looks like probably electric in nature. But the list of proposed explanations for ball lightning is long and ridiculous. I've seen ball lightning one time. And due to its extreme rarity, science has never been able to study it under controlled conditions. No one knows what it is, and using an unexplained phenomenon to explain away an unexplained phenomenon seems like the definition of madness. But it's understandable that folks would be looking for something to make a giant dancing fireball seem a bit more mundane. No matter what name you give it, it's still a giant dancing fireball in the sky. It is an interesting video. They're very far away from it. You just see what it almost looks like. Someone has a big sparkler or like a big torch, and they're just waving it around in the sky. So, check out the MU article, and then it links to the kind of original article, and that's where the video is. This last story has really been making the rounds the past week. It's gone from kind of quirky story to people have almost made it a cryptid. I think they're doing it tongue in cheek, but I've seen out there of illustrations of, hey, look at this new thing we got. And this is coming from 6 ABC Action News. This article is written by anyone. I don't see a name on this one. And this is man wearing TV on head caught on camera leaving old TVs on Virginia front porches. Henrico County, Virginia. Residents living in a Virginia neighborhood woke up to find free televisions on their doorsteps. It sounds like a great gift until you see they are older box sets left at the homes. He is committed to his trade, said homeowner Jim Brooksbank. No need to adjust that dial. Doorbell surveillance cameras capture the man with a TV set over his head, lying an older TV set down on someone's front porch, and just watch walking off. He wants to be known as the TV Santa Claus. I don't know, Brooksbank told WTVR-TV. The bizarre discovery happened Sunday morning in Henrico's Hampshire neighborhood. Outed boxes were found on more than 50 homes. We've got an old tube-style TV, 13-inch, said Brooksbank. I thought my son had brought it home, but apparently not. They had way too much time on their hands if all they had were these TVs and spread them all over the neighborhood, said homeowner Michael Kroll. Henrico police are tuned into the situation. They have security camera video from multiple neighbors, but think it's only a prank targeting no one in particular. At most, it seems to be a more inconvenience to the community, said one officer. Officers and county workers spent Sunday morning picking up the old units and hauling them away. The police did a great job of coming up and collecting them all, said Brooksbank. This is the second time the TV set mystery has played out. In Glen Allen, the same thing happened in a different neighborhood last August. I think it's just a prank. Some college students who are just bored, said Kroll. It's summer, and people are getting ready to go back to school. Maybe TV Man was just ready to strike and put a little humor in our lives, said Brooksbank. In the absence of knowing the brains inside the box, these homeowners are only left to guess what it all means. According to Henrico Police, the only real crime committed was illegal dumping. And that has been this week's local headlines. We will return after the boom with, of course, a couple of little listener stories and finish up this episode. And we've got two little stories, nothing big, but little and fun. The first one is from Reddit, and they asked to remain anonymous, so I'm just going to call them Reddit user. And this is from outside of Eureka, California. Before Christmas, 1996, maybe 1997, I was driving from Eureka, California to Los Angeles, which is a bit of a drive. I bet it's 9 hours. I bet it's 10. I left early, around 4 a.m., well before sunrise. I hadn't been driving an hour, but I was deep in the Redwood Forest on Highway 101. It was still complete darkness. A Tribe Called Quest was playing loudly on the cassette. The only light was coming from the headlights on my car. Then, in my peripheral vision, I quickly caught the light in the rear view mirror on the highway behind me. Suddenly it caught up, and with a powerful glowing light shined down on the car. I felt just an instant flash of sleep paralysis, something I hadn't felt since I was 12 or 13. The light moved on ahead of me, and I saw a cone of light illuminating down from a small, bright source. It moved forward on the road in front of me, and then all over the tall redwood trees and out of sight. Fucking logging helicopter, I thought, and not much else. I finished the drive to Los Angeles, spent Christmas with the family. Everything was pretty uneventful. After New Year's, I drove back up to Eureka, but when I got home, something was different. Around those years, I was a nerd about time and punctuality. My watch, my alarm, clock, VCR, stove, car clock, and wall clock were all synchronized. I got into my apartment and noticed my watch was 12 minutes slower than all the clocks in my apartment. I went down to the car and turned it on. The clock on the dash matched my watch. I went back to the apartment and called for the time. My watch and car were synchronized at 12 minutes slow. Maybe it wasn't a logging helicopter after all, I thought. And I like this story because it has missing time, but the car also had the time. So it, you know, it's like he was in this bubble of missing time, and everything that was in the bubble, the car included, also, you know, so was he abducted? If he was abducted, he was abducted with the entire car, or something happened to that effect. It was just very, you know, it was more than just missing time, because he was able to kind of synchronize it and find it out and be like, you know, just the fact that the car was also missing the same amount of time really lends to a what the hell moment on that one. And this next one is from Bree Havy, I think is how you say her last name, from Jamestown, Rhode Island. And she wrote in with a little story, and she sent some pictures of the place she's talking about. I'll put a couple, a few select ones on in the show notes, and I'll probably, maybe I'll post them all on Instagram or something so you guys can take a look. But she wrote this in. My mom married a guy when my parents got divorced, and that moved us to a small Rhode Island town of Jamestown. I was a teenager here and did a lot of teenagerly things. A local hangout spot for delinquents was an abandoned military fort known as Fort Weatherhill. No, I'm sorry, Weatherwill. It's a real cool spot made out of concrete, most of it underground. Kids go there to smoke pot, graffiti things. We had a small problem with people sacrificing cats to Satan in one of the downstairs rooms at one point. It was a whole thing. A local fraternity hazes new members in that room now. It's calmed down, been cleaned up. People hike there now. Kids still do drugs. But anyway, when I moved to Jamestown, all the locals would warn you about a demon dog that haunted the ruins. Different people had different accounts. Someone said it was a hellhound. Others said it was a werewolf. Regardless, we were always warned never to go out at night. I have obviously been at night, and it's gotten a little wild. Here's a link to the story to give you some history. And she did. She linked to a news article from the Yankee Express. Let's take a look at it. If not too long, maybe I'll just read it. Yeah, it's not too bad. This is from the Yankee Express, The Phantom Dog of Fort Weatherwill by Thomas D'Augusto, and this is from Haunted Rhode Island. A demon dog is known to wander among the ruins of Fort Weatherwill in Jamestown. I wanted to say Jonestown. Jamestown, Rhode Island. Witnesses have seen the wraith approaching them with its glowing red eyes and white fangs protruding from its gaping mouth. Whether or not those who have gazed upon the creature have met with an untimely death has not been ascertained. The origin of the dog is not clear as well, but one could trace it back to the time when the English controlled the fort during the American Revolution. Accounts of these hideous creatures are abundant in Great Britain. One such animal is called the Muth Dug, I think. It's got two O's in it. And is known through history to haunt the Castle Peel on the Isle of Man. The very sight of the dog was a harbinger of death. A guard once saw the dog in a corridor and was so frightened by the sight he died a few days later, never recovering from his ordeal. Another guard entered the office within the castle and saw the same dog on a chair grimacing at him. The apparition was so horrifying that he succumbed to death moments after the shrieks reverberated through the castle. Sentries of the castle, like sentries, like guards, now know to avert their eyes when they see the shadow of the phantom in the view, or they turn their head in the opposite direction for the fear that same fate might be bestowed upon them and many of their comrades. Other such omens of death reside in areas of Norfolk, Essex, and Suffolk, along the hills and coastlines of the United Kingdom. He has also known to roam graveyards and the country roads for centuries. Villagers gaze upon the ghastly canine known as the Black Shuck, and have never lived to tell the tale about their encounter with the deadly demon. When the British took control of Jamestown Hill during the American Revolution, it was known as Dumpling Rock. Colonists had made crude earthwork walls on the rocky hill to control the eastern passageway into Newport. They occupied the fort until July 30 of 1778, when the French gained control of the harbor. The British fled and destroyed the fort, but took it over again a month later. It stayed under their control until October 25, 1779, when they hastily abandoned the fort without explanation. Whether or not the Black Demon had anything to do with it is not written, but something other than the armed forces made them hastily retreat that position. A better fortress was erected and called Fort Dumpling, or Fort Louis, as some referred to it in honor of the King of France. They soon abandoned the fort unexpectedly. It was not until 1899, 100 years later, that the United States government expanded the fort and put disappearing rifles into the cement embankments and renamed it Fort Weatherwill. It was then put into caretaker status until World War II, but once again, it was mysteriously abandoned. The state acquired the property for public use on August 16, 1972. Now, the only original dweller of the fort is the black dog that roams the area looking for those who will gaze into its fiery eyes. Barking has been heard from inside the walls of the fort, yet investigators always prove the structure is empty of any living creature. He is also seen walking through the walls and steel doors of the fortress as if they did not exist during his original tenure at the hill. The phantom dog is nomadic and chooses its victims at random. Those who unexpectedly run into the demon are sure to experience the worst of fates. So if you find yourself at Fort Rotherwell State Park, perhaps you might want to avoid calling the dark pooch with glowing eyes you see in the distance, wandering among the ruins. And like I said, she sent me a bunch of pictures. I will probably put them all on Instagram, and I'll link, like I said, I'll link a couple in the show notes, a couple of the more intriguing ones. But that has been listener stories for this week's episode, and that means it's also the end of the show. And I would like to thank everyone for taking the time to listen. If you like the show, if you like what you heard, please rate, subscribe, and rate, review, and subscribe. I knew I was messing something up. Rate, review, and subscribe the podcast on your player of choice, especially if it's iTunes. What else we got? If you have a story for the show, there are a bunch of ways to get it to me. If you go to stscast.com, where you can find all sorts of goodies such as episodes, all the sources, all the links to anything we've covered, all the pictures I've got are on there, merch is on there, ways to support the show are on there. But also at the bottom of the main page, there is an email form where you can email me, send me your story or any questions you have. You can also get on social media, Twitter and Facebook both use the same name. It's at STScast. I'm also on Instagram. That one is STScast.gram. I'm most active on Twitter. So if you have a story, you can also find me on there and get it to me. Also, if you're a Reddit user, there is a Reddit. I have a subreddit that is entitled, I've actually forgotten what it's called. I'm going to have to look it up. STS Listener Stories. You can go and join, and you can get in there and leave some stories, and we can talk about them. We can do all sorts of great things in there. Like I said, there are other ways to support the show. Just tell a friend. Word of mouth works the best. Get on social media. Go, hey, I like this. Here's this new episode. It's really great. Retweet some stuff. Like some stuff. You know, you can get on the website. You can buy merch. You can go support Big Heads Media. They also have merch for the show through them. You can check out the Dirty Knees Soap Company link. All that helps the show, helps it to keep going. I can't thank everyone enough for the support and the listens and just all of that stuff that has come from doing this show. And season two is off and started with, I think, a pretty good episode. Way longer than I thought it was going to be. I really didn't think. I was like, man, I don't have a lot of stuff on Adelphi, Texas. Like, there just wasn't a whole lot of information out there. But I think it all came together, and this has been a good one, and I'm happy to get it wrapped up and out for everyone to listen. So, until next time, remember that every town has a secret. What is yours?
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.